I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We demand that Google drop Project Nimbus, the $1.2 billion contract between them and Israel. We demand that Google protect their Arab, Muslim, and Palestinian worker voices from harassment, retaliation, suppression. And we demand that Google recognize Project Nimbus as a workplace safety and health concern.
At least 9 Google workers are arrested after sitting in at the company's offices in New York and the Google CEO's office in Sunnyvale, California, to protest the tech giant's work with the Israeli government. We'll speak with 2 of them and an organizer with the No Tech for Apartheid campaign. Then 4,000 Volkswagen workers in Chattanooga, Tennessee, begin voting to join the United Auto Workers as it tries to expand in the South. We'll speak with labor journalist Hamilton Nolan, author of The Hammer: Power, Inequality, and the Struggle for the Soul of Labor. But first, it's the one-year anniversary of the civil war in Sudan, which has created one of the world's worst humanitarian crises.
This is more than a conflict between two warring parties. It is a war being waged on the Sudanese people. It is a war on the many thousands of civilians who have been killed and tens of thousands maimed for life.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United Nations has accused Israel of continuing to unlawfully restrict aid into Gaza, despite acknowledgments by the United States that parts of Gaza are already experiencing famine. Ravina Shamdasani of the UN Human Rights Office spoke in Geneva Tuesday.
Israel continues to impose unlawful restrictions on the entry and distribution of humanitarian assistance, carry out widespread destruction of civilian infrastructure as well.
This comes as the official death toll in Gaza nears 34,000, including over 14,000 children and 10,000 women. A new report by UN Women finds Israel's assault on Gaza has left more than 19,000 children orphaned. Earlier today, Israel struck a playground and busy market in the Maghazi refugee camp. Tension remains high in the Middle East as world leaders urge Israel to show restraint following Iran's recent drone and missile attack. British Foreign Secretary David Cameron has urged Israel to do, quote, as little as possible to escalate tensions with Iran. Meanwhile, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has accused Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of provoking Iran by first bombing the Iranian consulate in Damascus, Syria, 2 weeks ago.
Netanyahu is endangering the lives of both his own citizens and all the peoples in the region to extend his political life. This is an indisputable fact. The one responsible for the tension that made our hearts skip a beat on the night of April 13 is Netanyahu and his government, which is seeing red.
The United Nations Human Rights Office is calling on Israel to stop supporting violent Jewish settlers in the occupied West Bank. In recent days, settlers have killed at least 3 Palestinians and attacked a number of villages, burning dozens of homes to the ground. Human Rights Watch has accused Israeli military forces of either taking part in the attacks or failing to protect Palestinians from the settlers. Meanwhile, The Guardian's revealed Israel's been speeding up plans over the past 6 months to build thousands of housing units in new illegal settlements in East Jerusalem. At least 9 workers at Google were arrested Tuesday after staging sit-ins at the company's offices here in New York City and in Sunnyvale, California, in the CEO's office, to protest Project Nimbus, a $1.2 billion contract to provide cloud computing services to the Israeli government and military. Iman Hassim is a Google software engineer in Sunnyvale.
We demand that Google drop Project Nimbus, the $1.2 billion contract between them and Israel. We demand that Google protect their Arab, Muslim, and Palestinian worker voices from harassment, retaliation, suppression, and we demand that Google recognize Project Nimbus as a workplace safety and health concern.
We'll have more on Google later in the show, with two of those Google workers arrested. In other protest news, students at Columbia University and Barnard College have set up dozens of tents on campus to create what they're calling a Gaza solidarity encampment. This is Isra Hirsi, a student at Barnard, who's the daughter of Congressmember Ilhan Omar.
Hello, I am a organizer with TU Apartheid Divest. Today we have over 100 plus people who have come together to form the Gaza Solidarity Encampment. Today we are calling for divestment. We are calling for amnesty for suspended students, as well as transparency from Columbia University on what they invest in.
The president of Columbia University is testifying before Congress today. The first seven jurors have been selected in Donald Trump's hush money criminal trial. Jury selections expected to continue on Thursday. Opening arguments could begin as soon as Monday. Judge Juan Merchan has admonished the former president for intimidating jurors after Trump was heard muttering something under his breath during jury selection. On Tuesday, Trump reportedly fell asleep during the proceedings for a second day in a row. Trump's charged with 34 felony counts of falsifying business records to hide a $130,000 payment to adult film star Stormy Daniels ahead of the 2016 election. The U.S. Supreme Court's weighing whether the Justice Department has improperly used a federal obstruction law to charge more than 350 people involved in the January 6th insurrection. Several justices appeared skeptical of the DOJ's reasoning during oral arguments Tuesday. This is Justice Clarence Thomas.
There have been many violent protests that have interfered with proceedings. Has the government applied this provision to other protests in the past? And has this been the government's position throughout the lifespan of the statute?
Justice Thomas has refused to recuse himself from cases related to the January 6th insurrection, even though his wife, Ginny Thomas, attended Trump's Stop the Steal rally on the Eclipse just before Trump supporters attacked the Capitol. The Supreme Court's decision could also impact the prosecution of Donald Trump, who faces four counts under the law, which was passed after the Enron scandal. The possible extradition of imprisoned WikiLeaks publisher Julian Assange to the United States has edged a step closer. On Tuesday, the Biden administration provided assurances to the British High Court that Assange would not face the death penalty and that his First Amendment rights would be protected if he were to be extradited from Britain, where he's been locked up for years. Assange's wife, Stella, slammed the U.S. response, saying, quote, "The diplomatic note does nothing to relieve our family's extreme distress about his future, his grim expectation of spending the rest of his life in isolation in U.S. prison for publishing award-winning journalism," she said. In news from India, security forces have killed 29 Maoist rebels in the central state of Chhattisgarh just days before India's national elections begin. It was one of the deadliest attacks on the Naxalite movement in years. In news from Capitol Hill, Republican Congressmember Thomas Massey of Kentucky has joined Congressmember Marjorie Taylor Greene's bid to oust Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson. Massey made the announcement a day after Johnson unveiled a plan to advance separate bills to send aid to Israel, Ukraine, and Taiwan. Meanwhile, House Republicans have finally sent articles of impeachment against Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas to the Senate. In voting news, Maine's become the latest state to join the National Popular Vote Compact, which could transform the way presidents are elected in the United States. 16 states and Washington, D.C. have now pledged to award their combined 209 electoral votes to the presidential candidate who wins the nationwide popular vote. The compact will only go into effect once supporters of the compact control at least 270 votes. Support for the National Popular Vote Compact has grown in recent years after both George W. Bush and Donald Trump were elected president despite losing the popular vote. In California, a former U.S. Marine has been sentenced to 9 years in prison for firebombing a Planned Parenthood clinic in Costa Mesa in 2022. Chance Brannon pleaded guilty in November. He admitted he'd also planned to attack a second Planned Parenthood clinic and an LGBTQ pride celebration at Dodger Stadium in Los Angeles. Two other people involved have also pleaded guilty and will be sentenced in May. In a major win for LGBTQ rights advocates, a federal appeals court has blocked West Virginia's measure banning transgender children and youth from participating in public school and college sports. The ruling stemmed from a case involving 13-year-old Becky Pepper Jackson, a trans athlete who's been challenging West Virginia's ban since 2021. Meanwhile, the U.S. Supreme Court is allowing Idaho to enforce its ban on gender-affirming care for transgender youth while lawsuits over the measure are heard in lower courts. Under the law, physicians in Idaho face up to 10 years in prison for providing hormones, puberty blockers, or other gender-affirming care to trans children under the age of 18. And here in New York, two police officers involved in the fatal shooting of Kowaski Trawick in 2019 will not face internal discipline. New York's police commissioner, Edward Caban, said officers Brendan Thompson and Herbert Davis, quote, acted within the law when they entered Trawick's Bronx apartment and Officer Thompson, who's white, shot him four times. Trawick, who was 32, an aspiring dancer, had a history of mental illness and was living in special housing when he called 911. The two officers found Trawick holding a knife as he repeatedly told them he was cooking and asked why the officers were inside his home. The full incident lasted less than 2 minutes. The officers did not face criminal charges. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
1 year ago this week, a devastating civil war erupted in Sudan when a fragile alliance between the Sudanese armed forces and the paramilitary group, the Rapid Support Forces, collapsed, pitting the two sides against each other. The war initially began around the capital city of Khartoum, but quickly spread to other parts of Sudan, including Darfur, Port Sudan, and Gezira State, situated in the country's agricultural heartland. 1 year on, the conflict has created what the UN High Commissioner for Refugees has called, quote, one of the worst displacement and humanitarian crises in the world, and one of the most neglected and ignored. More than 8.6 million people have been driven from their homes, creating the world's largest displacement crisis. A new report by the International Organization for Migration has found 20,000 people are forced to flee their homes in Sudan every day, half of them children. The crisis has been compounded by food insecurity, with the World Food Program recently warning Sudan's facing the world's largest hunger crisis. The number of Sudanese facing emergency levels of hunger, one stage before famine, has more than tripled in a year to almost 5 million, according to the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, a UN-backed index. Save the Children has warned that 230,000 children, pregnant women, and newborn mothers could die of malnutrition in the coming months. Meanwhile, Sudan's health system has collapsed, allowing outbreaks of diseases, including measles and cholera. The war erupted April 15, 2023, when a planned political transition following the ouster and a popular uprising of President Omar al-Bashir after 30 years in power fell apart between the Sudanese army and the Rapid Support Forces. For more, we're joined by Khaled Mustafa Medeni, an associate professor of political science and Islamic studies at McGill University, chair of the African Studies program there. His recent piece for Merup is headlined "The Struggle for Sudan, a Primer." Welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you here in studio in New York, Professor. If you can start off by telling us where Sudan stands 1 year after the war erupted.
Well, first of all, thank you, Amy, for having me on the show. It's a real honor. Thank you for your coverage of Sudan. I think that where we stand is an unbelievable kind of what the Doctors Without Borders have called a failure of humanity. I think that there are very few crises in the world historically including in Africa, where there's been such an acceleration in just 1 year of the kind of devastation that you just itemized. 9 million displaced internally, over 1 million across the borders, the 7 borders of Sudan, mostly in Chad, Egypt, and South Sudan, and the complete destruction of the infrastructure. In addition to that, in December of last year, something occurred that has accelerated the famine, basically, not just food insecurity, but the expansion of the famine. And that is the attack on the Jazira state in central Sudan, which really produces over 60% of the agricultural products of the country. In addition to that, of course, there are 70% of the hospitals that are destroyed. The educational system has completely collapsed. And so the acceleration of this kind of devastation, I don't think we've seen since perhaps maybe the genocide in Rwanda. And I think that compounding that for those of us, of course, concerned about the situation is the lack of attention to the conflict. Of course, eyes are elsewhere, but that has been a really problematic aspect of this conflict so far.
And Professor, you remarked that this is a war that doesn't have a support for either side among the Sudanese people. Could you talk about that and also the roots of this conflict going back to the revolution of 2017 and 2018, how that informed these current warring parties?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the very kind of unique aspects of this particular war, and local Sudanese have insisted, including in Darfur, one of the most ravaged regions, that this is not a civil war, that this is essentially a war between two generals. On the one side, Abdel Fattah Burhan, who's the head of the Sudan Armed Forces. On the other side, the militia leader, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, known as Hemeti. And whereas, in general, civil wars are characterized by, two groups with some kind of significant constituency in civil society supporting one side or the other. In this particular case, the war has absolutely no legitimacy in civil society and no real constituency for either side. And that, I think, is unique in the history of conflicts in Africa, and I would argue elsewhere. The reason for that has very much to do with what you said, and that is the genesis and the root of the war really is the revolution of 2018-2019 that many people followed throughout the world. And what was unique about that particular pro-democracy revolution is that it encompassed the entire country. It wasn't just in the urban areas, it wasn't just in the rural areas, it wasn't just middle-class Sudanese, but Sudanese across social classes, Sudanese across regions, across ethnicities, rose up in late 2018 as a result of implementation of economic policies that raised the price of consumer goods, and it expanded over a 6 month period, leading, as you probably know, to the downfall and the ouster of an authoritarian regime led by Omar Bashir that lasted for 30 years and had conducted or executed 3 different wars in the country. That is really the genesis for viewers and listeners to understand, because this war is essentially a war against that revolution. It's a war against the Sudanese people. Both of these generals, while they have a great deal of competition over resources, over political power, have one thing in common, and that is their fear of this kind of revolutionary potential, and their essentially fear of Sudanese civil society. That's why, in addition to all of the kind of devastation that we've been talking about, a key aspect of the targeting has been civilians. Civilians, of course, have been the greatest victims, and not just randomly. I'm talking about not only doctors and journalists, but also activists and those members of what we call in Sudan and are well known to be the grassroots resistance committees that led the revolution. Those people are either being targeted and killed or expelled from the country or forced to leave the country. And so that becomes a really important aspect of the root of this particular kind of conflict in Sudan.
And could you talk also about the influence of outside governments on the conflict and in preventing a ceasefire, especially Egypt and the United Arab Emirates, and where is the African Union on this?
Well, it's very important to understand that the external forces had very much to do with supporting what was a fragile coalition between civilian leaders and military leaders. At that time, there was an alliance between these two warring generals, which I think that it's very important to understand. Because of the continued protest for democracy in Sudan, by the end of 2022, there was something called a framework agreement, basically talks to bring together civilian leaders and these generals in order to oversee a transition to democracy. That was overseen by the international community, in particular the United States, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, the EU. And the genesis of the external involvement and the failure to see Sudan through peace and a democratic transition really has to be understood in that context. It was at that point that I would argue that the failure of achieving a civilian transition occurred, and it was, of course, a result of the machinations of these two generals, but also the lack of foresight with respect to external actors at the time, specifically the lack of inclusion of the very forces and groups and youth and resistance committees and civil society organizations that really were the ones who mobilized for the revolution. So that is really important. That failure of the framework agreement, it was accelerated, it was not inclusive, and of course, as you know, the catalyst for this war began in the context of a contentious issue around merging the militias into the standing army. That, of course, would have led to the lack of autonomy and power of the militia leader who has gone to war against the Sudan Armed Forces. And at the same time, of course, the Sudan Armed Forces, Burhan at its head, was very concerned about having two command and control institutions. In essence, he wanted to control the country. So to answer your question currently about external actors, that is the genesis of their lack of foresight in terms of really supporting the revolution, in my view. And to bring it up to date, the kind of variety of interest, Egypt's interest in and support of the Sudan Armed Forces, the United Arab Emirates' support of the militia, and Saudi Arabia's support also of the Sudan Armed Forces, has led to this situation where we have up to three or four different peace initiatives, one in Saudi Arabia, headed by the U.S., one in Djibouti, headed by IGAD, the regional bloc, another headed by the UAE that was recently held in Bahrain. Basically, competing peace initiatives that have obstructed, number one, a resolution to the conflict in terms of implementing a ceasefire, but also motivated these two generals because basically they're utilizing their patrons, whether it's outside forces, in order to perpetuate the war against the Sudanese people. So I hope that makes sense, but we do have to get back and understand the initial failures of the international community in really implementing a peace agreement that would really satisfy the roots of the problems in Sudan, but most specifically those forces, including resistance committees, young people, civil society organizations that mobilized for the revolution. The reason I mentioned that is that any resolution to this conflict would require getting back to that, an understanding, given that this is a war against the civilian population, the support must be given to the civilian population and immediately be included in any peace initiative that would seek to resolve this conflict.
Professor, on Monday, the French President Emmanuel Macron announced that donors had pledged more than $2 billion to Sudan. He was speaking at an international conference in Paris aimed at increasing humanitarian aid to Sudan.
Even if today there are far too many conflicts, and they are conflicts that are covered more by the press and diplomatic efforts, our duty was to make it clear that we are not forgetting what is happening in Sudan, that we remain mobilized, that there are no double standards. We can announce that more than 2 billion euros will be mobilized for the women and men of Sudan. Before this conference, we had a commitment of 190 million euros. This evening, we are at 2 billion euros for Sudan.
So that's French President Emmanuel Macron at this international conference in Paris. If you can talk also about the role of France, but overall, what the international community can do to be most supportive to ending this war.
Well, of course, it's good news. The priority, of course, is to address the humanitarian crisis. There is absolutely no question about that. The 2 billion euros, important. There have been a lot of different initiatives on the part of the United Nations. Very few have met the targets. And this is one of the reasons Doctors Without Borders has called it a failure of humanity, because of the lack of donor, pledges and support. The 2 billion euros are important, but it's very important to understand that one of the central aspects of this conflict is the way that these two parties are using food delivery and aid delivery as a weapon of war, not only in terms of targeting aid workers, but also, setting up bureaucratic blockages, refusing permits for aid workers. And the reason I mentioned that is the 2 billion is extremely important. But the problem is that without a really vigorous political intervention, without understanding that this aid must be implemented or utilized in the context simultaneously with a vigorous political intervention that seeks to stop the war. And the reason I say that is one of the most important problematics at the moment, as I mentioned, is the lack of coherent coordination on the part of external actors, with France and the EU, of course, pledging this money, Canada and the United States utilizing sanctions against these two generals, but a lack of coordination that would, A, include civil society organization to set the agenda for a ceasefire and to implement that kind of ceasefire. And also, this kind of pledge, while it's so important, it really does not make up for the destruction of the distributive networks in Sudan. Aid is an absolutely important aspect, but what is happening now is so severe in terms of food insecurity and the famine that the support of local Sudanese, including organizations that were transformed from resistance communities into voluntary association, like emergency response rooms. So what we need is a very vigorous political intervention, coordination between the different actors, and I'm talking about the Gulf countries, the United States, Europe, and African countries. All of them have a stake in this conflict. The reason that this pledge has gone through, one of the reasons, is the recognition on the part of external actors, to be quite honest, Amy, that there is not only a huge humanitarian crisis, but the spillover effect across the region, the Red Sea region, the strategic areas that are of such concern to the Gulf countries, to the United States, to Europe, the issue of migration. All of that necessitates a coordinated understanding of the problem or of the intervention, that everyone has a great deal to lose from this conflict. So the pledge is important and very, very important, useful and vital, but without a political coordinated intervention that includes civil society forces and supports local Sudanese organizations like the emergency response rooms, the Darfur Association, and others, we won't really see kind of the restoration of peace.
Professor, I just have one question that maybe you could address briefly. A war of this length obviously requires weapons. Who is supplying the weapons to both sides, and what could be done to put pressure on the arms suppliers of the warring parties?
Well, the problem is that in the Sahel region, in Africa in general, the smuggling of arms is something that is very difficult to control completely. What we call the small arms trade that is really encompasses the entire Sahel region. One of the issues of the arms supplies for the militias has to do previously with the supply of arms that was brought in by United Arab Emirates. That is something that is well known. The Russian Wagner Group also was facilitating arms to the militia. The arms that the Sudan Armed Forces have, of course, number one, has to do with its own stock. It is the Sudan Armed Forces and had received a lot of arms supplies recently as they began to lose the war, particularly after the fall of Jazeera, the central state. They have been getting arms and drones from Iran as a last resort because of the grave situation they find. So we have Gulf countries involved, Iran involved, the small arms trade. That
requires, of course, great attention. There have been sanctions implemented against the financing of these arms through the corporations of both the militia leaders and the Sudan Armed Forces, who are supported, I want to add, by extremist Islamists as the only small coalition left to support them. So there is a complex of external actors and of informal trade of arms. That is important to pay attention to, but without really looking at the ways to implement a ceasefire and restore peace, it's just a stopgap kind of policy or intervention. So it is important, but once again, we have to really bring these regional actors into play. The United States, as you know, has finally appointed a special envoy to Sudan, who has, interestingly enough, reiterated much of what I'm saying, and that is that there needs to be a coordination among the regional actors, the ending of arms supplies by certain actors to the different warring parties. And interestingly enough, he has also emphasized the importance of taking civil society